Can I help? Who's next?
Yeah, that would be me.
Did you fill out the lost item form? You've got to go to the back of the line if you didn't fill out the lost item form.
I filled it out. Here you go.
Most people, when they get to my window and it turns out they haven't filled out the lost item form and I have to send them to the end of the line, they get really angry.
That must be really stressful for you.
No, it's kind of fun, actually. It passes the time.
I'm here because I lost...
Let me see the form. You've got terrible handwriting. It says you lost your senile hummus. Nobody's turned in any hummus, senile or otherwise.
No. It says sense of humor. I lost a sense of humor, my sense of humor, sometime during this election cycle.
What did it look like?
Well, it was great. People said I had a great sense of humor, but also kind of twisted. Do you have any twisted ones back there?
Lady, you have no idea how many people lost their sense of humor this year. We got thousands of them on the shelves in the back. You got to give me more to go on. What did you used to think was funny?
I don't remember. That's kind of the point. Oh, I know. Ducks.
Everybody says ducks.
Three-hole punches. Aardvarks. Flotation devices. Pants. Anything stroganoff. Monkeys. Flossing. Haiku.
I think I saw that one in the back. This it?
No, that one says property of Joyce Carol Oates on the side.
Just take it. You'll grow into it. Can I help? Who's next?
Wait, no, I refuse to have my sense of humor be a casualty of this election season. I'm not taking somebody else's.
In that case, you have to fill out a dispute resolution form and go to the back of the line. Now, that's the kind of thing I find funny.
Today on the show, how the election looks and feels from the heartland and from a distance. And now he brought a sense of humor to the repair shop and they gave him Mike Pence's as a loner. Colin McEnroe.
Yeah, it just turns out Mike Pence's it doesn't have a lot of pickup. It doesn't have a lot of, you know, you hit the gas and nothing really happens when you have Mike Pence's sense of humor as a loner. Well, that was fun. I have missed, that's Katie Tularski with Kion Wolf in the role of the bored, unhelpful clerk, a voice that Katie over the years has played a few times on her show, and she just gets better and better. All right, so we're going to be talking about the election today. We're in a moment of mild confusion because one of our guests gave us the wrong phone number, but we're working that out. We're gonna figure that whole thing out. While we're waiting for that to be resolved, let me tell you a few things. First of all, Kion Wolf is activating a voicemail project on how people plan on emotionally coping on Election Day. By the way, I think that ship has sailed for me. Like, I'm just not going to be able to emotionally cope. I stopped being able to emotionally cope yesterday, so I won't be calling this voicemail line. Will you be spending time around the friends, screaming into a void all alone while rocking back and forth? That would be me, except I have to work. Self-medicating with a nice long hike away from screens. Whatever the answer is, or how you are emotionally coping on Election Day, we want you to call. Get ready now. 860-580-9677. I'll say it one more time. 860-580-9677. As long as I'm doing housekeeping stuff, let me just say a couple of other things here. One of them is that tomorrow we're going to do our Citizen Observer program. We do this every election cycle. We have done it since the first time we were on the air 7 years ago. I don't know whether that's true or not, but I'm just going to say it. I think it is true. And so what we do is we collect a bunch of pretty diverse people from diverse walks of life, but they're not journalists and they're not political professionals. They're not anything like that. They include typically a farmer and a folk singer and a clergy person. And this year, I think we're going to have Barry Blitt, who draws. He's probably the closest thing to a journalist. He draws some of those really incendiary and very funny New Yorker covers. People who vote in Connecticut, that's the key. You have to go vote in Connecticut, and then you talk to us about the experience of voting. Not who you voted for or anything like that, but just sort of, you know, what it feels like. You know, Whitman wrote a poem about Election Day as, you know, this great choosing day that was more powerful than Niagara or something. I don't know. I don't have the poem in front of me. Something like that. But there's a sense in which, you know, this moment, this fundamental moment of democracy is like this huge big deal that we all participate and we partake of its gigantic spirit, its transcendent spirit, or we're just really depressed and screaming, rocking back and forth, to quote from the previous announcement. So, you know, anyway, that's what we're going to do tomorrow, and it's always really interesting. I just take my word for it, and it will be very interesting, too. Also, I think this is my final announcement for now. The station, WNPR, is doing something on Facebook Live. And it's like Jeff Cohn and Ryan King and Heather Brandon. They're just all day long. They're going to keep Facebook Live Facebook Living? Facebooking Live? They're going to do something, but they're going to have like a lot of really interesting stuff on Facebook Live. I assume you have to go to the WNPR page on Facebook to get all this stuff. But there's going to be all kinds of – they're going to go to the polls. They're going to vote, or they're going to watch John Dankosky vote in Winstead, where sheep and goats are – no, sheep and cows are allowed to vote. Goats cannot vote in Winstead. Don't bring your goat to the polls tomorrow. And, I mean, they're going to go all over the place. They're going to come here right before we do the Citizen Observer program. They're going to interview producer Betsy Kaplan about what it is we're about to do. And then I think they'll probably go in with Wolfie or something. Anyway, Facebook Live. That's the thing I want you to remember, if you remember nothing else. All right. So it does seem as though one of the unpleasant surprises of this election season is how surprised we are. We're really surprised by our fellow Americans. Not that we haven't known for decades and decades and decades that there were people who were not like us, whose lived experiences were very different from ours, whose discontents existed in some sphere different from our own. We've always known that kind of stuff. But it seems as though it's more plaintive and powerful than it's ever been before. And it's sort of like, how do we get to know these people, you know, except in like social media where there's this kind of multiplier effect of hostility. And you feel like anyway, you're not really talking in a real way. So where would you go? What would you do? How would you go and find some people who were really different from you? Well, Rinker Buck, journalist and author, decided to do something about that. He is the author of Flight of Passage, a memoir, and The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. He recently traveled down the Monongahela, Ohio, and Mississippi rivers from Pennsylvania to New Orleans, and has basically been hearing the stories in particular of Trump supporters as if told to Mark Twain or to some Mark Twain character. So Rinker is joining us to tell us a little bit more about who he met and what he found. Hi, Rinker.
Hey, Colin. It's great to see you.
Yes.
Great to hear from you.
So first of all, maybe you should tell us about this boat. This is like an old-fashioned flatboat, the way things used to get moved around a lot, and still to some extent do, right?
Sure. These history books that I write, I often like to experience what it was like at the time. And my next book is about the flatboat era, which was a largely forgotten era, but it's also responsible for creating the American economy we know today, where farmers from the Midwest, as early as right after the Revolution, were shipping products, you know, salt pork and grain, coal and wood and all this, out to the port of New Orleans by going down the Mississippi River system. So I built a 36-foot flatboat in Tennessee and sailed it from Pittsburgh 2,000 miles down to New Orleans, down the Ohio and Mississippi rivers. So was going through a lot of the country, and I spent 4 months doing that this summer, and was going through a lot of the country where you could very reliably depend on throwing a line to someone who's going to help you get ashore, who's probably got a Trump hat, Make America Great Again. And so it was a process of sort of understanding them and their motives in a lot of cases.
So you've got 4 months worth of stories. People will have to wait for the book for some of them, but we
sure
can tell some of them today. For example, you were in West Virginia, in a town that's famous for its steelworks. Tell us about who you found there. What did you learn from these people who were sort of part of the coal continuum?
Sure. Weirtown, West Virginia is sort of a famous town now because it's right in the heart of the coal country, and their steel mill was taken over by the Union after the company decided to abandon it. And so it's very, very important coal country. And we reached there about the sixth or seventh day of our journey from Pittsburgh. And one of the things that was remarkable, because I had some crew members on, a couple crew members on there just helping us the first week, and they'd seen the Ohio before this, was how diminished the coal barge traffic was. This is a river, the Ohio is a river that just processes hundreds of millions of tons of coal a year and sends it downriver in these long 130-foot barges and so forth. So we stopped one day at a marina in Weirton, and we were in a situation where we needed fuel, and we also knew that we needed to get some extra gas tanks, so the marina operator was very helpful and took us back to his farm, and we bought a bunch of gas tanks from him. And as we were coming back, he said, well, you know, Obama destroyed the coal industry down here. It was Obama's decision to destroy the coal industry down here. And in instead of engaging him in an argument, I said, well, what do you mean? And, you know, all these environmental regulations and everything. And what's ironic about what he said, which I think reflected local sentiment greatly, is it was completely inaccurate, but he believed it passionately.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the coal industry destroyed the coal industry. You've got at a point when it was very, very clear that the lessening of the price and the increase in supply of oil and gas, which is mostly from fracking, and a lot of it right in that region, would doom coal. I mean, gas is so much cheaper now, and oil is so much cheaper now. The coal industry invested heavily in consolidating and buying up each other and all this kind of mergers and acquisition activity that we see on Wall Street and so forth. Well, two of those companies are in bankruptcy now. Of the three large companies, two are in bankruptcy now. And Donald Blankenship, the CEO of the third, is Massey Coal, is facing a long prison sentence for OSHA violations and that sort of thing. So the coal industry declined because of the market conditions that Republican conservatives favor, which is let the market determine what happens. Coal is just not competitive financially anymore with cheaper forms of energy, particularly natural gas. But the people down there are convinced that Obama created these conditions where the coal industry would fail. And what surprises me about it, it shows you how ideologically bound people are and how in Trump country people believe the message that's put out instead of actually studying the conditions that destroyed a major industry in their area. And what's most surprising about it or most concerning to me is if you don't know the causes of what happened to you and you don't know the truth about what's happening out there, how can you solve your problems?
Mm-hmm.
How can you rebuild your economy in an area like that? And in fact, much to the criticism of fellow Democrats, Hillary Clinton is the only candidate who has proposed a comprehensive plan for rebuilding coal country, which includes massive federal spending for new industries and massive federal spending for retraining workers. So you have this irony now, this irony of the age that we live in, of misinformation. Fox News arguing this point and MSNBC arguing the other, but all based on ideology, not facts. The irony of the age we live in is that the truth can't emerge because people are so embedded in a reality. And we found that all through the coal country. The other thing that was fascinating was seeing the number of coal-fired plants, which are being demobilized because coal just isn't competitive anymore. And they're either just being abandoned. We saw 30 or 40 of them along the river. They're just being abandoned. This is where all the electrical utility generation is done because you get the fuel to the electrical generating plant via the river. And I would say of the 40 or 50 of these we saw along the river, half were being abandoned and the other half are being converted to gas.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very dramatic. And of course, this region pitches very heavily towards Trump because a market condition that people had no control over has done something to their lives and destroyed their lives, destroyed their incomes. And we met a lot of people who worked. We were actually in New Madrid, Ohio, New Madrid, Missouri, at a time that a major utility plant was being closed. So instead of going down there with the attitude, well, I'm a northerner and these people aren't intelligent, my whole approach was, let me try and understand why these people are so angry. And what's happened in this age of new media communications and everything is that it's very easy to stigmatize someone and make that stigmata stick.
Yeah, I think one of the things that emerged, even in the materials that you sent over to us and the stuff that you blogged about, Rinker, is that sense. I think we sometimes tell ourselves an untruth, which is that political information is kind of segregated from all other information, and you get that a certain way. Whereas, you know, the impression that I got from you is, I mean, and I think it's true for us, too. It's for true for people everywhere, by and large, that, you know, you're embedded in a culture, and what you hear maybe politically from Fox News, because you're watching that, coincides pretty closely with maybe even the kinds of country music that you're listening to, and what you hear at church, and what you hear down at the coffee shop. And, you know, it isn't as though people go and turn on one tap and get all their political news and then shut it off and start doing other stuff. It's more that, particularly with something as pervasive and soul-infusing as the kind of despair that ignited this Trump revolution, it's probably permeating, you know, pretty much all of your life.
Yes, we all live in a cultural bubble, and it's a big, massive filter hanging over our heads through which information is sifted, like a huge colander over a whole region of the country. And so no information that can get through that colander can fit through the wrong size hole unless it's first interpreted as, well, Democrats are always bad. Obama was the worst because he was the first black president, or Obamacare, whatever. And the reality inside is so ironic and so different. One thing that was fascinating to me was you meet all these conservatives, and the first thing they ask is, you know, what sort of weapons are you carrying? And they're appalled that we weren't carrying weapons. And a couple of them, look, let me go back to the barn and get you a couple of rifles and guns and stuff, because you need to be protected when you get down south, particularly if we stopped at a city with a lot of blacks and stuff. And, of course, we had no trouble whatsoever. We didn't need any weapons. And it's just that's just their filter. But
even people, little old ladies would tell you needed guns, right?
The head of the Historical Society, I don't want to embarrass her, so I'm just going to say, in one of the loveliest Louisiana towns I've ever seen, it's a big tourist mecca and everything. It's got all these antebellum mansions and stuff. But the lady who runs the Historical Society and drove us around and gave us all these favors and everything, wonderful, wonderful gal, she's packing guns in her car, and was appalled that we were traveling without weapons. So here's the irony. These are the most gracious, hospitable people in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I pull up and tie up to a levee some night and realize the anchors I'm using that I was sent off from Tennessee, the folks really didn't understand what an anchor is and how it's effective, and I needed to build new anchors. So I pulled off, and this farmer came down, and I know all the farmers have big shops, and I said, you know, I need to make some new mushroom anchors in this way to sink in the mud better here. And I need some old disc harrows and some bar stock and stuff. Well, he said, come on back to the house. We'll fix it. And this happened several times during the trip where we made repairs on the boat. Very gracious guy. Most wonderful person you could meet. Get back to his house. Make the anchors. He refuses to take any money. And we sit down and we talk about his life. And first of all, his shop and man cave is, this was along the Mississippi shore. His shop and man cave is full of Confederate flags,
mm-hmm.
and Johnny Cash is playing on the big screen TV there and everything. He offers us a joint. So all these rednecks down there that you think is, you know, foreign country and opposed to hippiedom and all that kind of thing, many of them are big pot smokers.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, we get to talking about his life, and he says, well, my disability payment, they're all on disability of some sort. They're either veterans and they qualified for some kind of disability, or you can get disability quite easily down in the South, just claiming that the dust from driving your tractor for many years has caused lung damage. And there's big billboards everywhere in the South that you go, you know, get your disability now, call Conklin and Conklin, we guarantee you a payment. So the same guy, I'm thinking of one guy in particular, the same guy is collecting $80,000 to $100,000 a year, not to plant cotton. So, and he's wholly dependent as a farmer on a river system of delivering commodity grain down to New Orleans, which relies on billions and billions of dollars spent by the Army Corps of Engineers and the Coast Guard keeping the river open every year. So, and of course, when you get to the subject of welfare or the presidential race or whatever, oh, Obama just wants to make the government bigger and steal all our money and give it to poor people, et cetera, et cetera. And for some reason, I guess it has a lot to do with educational levels and just that general cultural colander that I spoke about. They see no irony in this. I mean, here's a guy completely dependent on government money, essentially living on the welfare of the federal government in the larger term, getting crop subsidies, getting a disability payment for which you and I wouldn't qualify for, et cetera, et cetera. And a whole farm system that is propped up by the federal government. And he doesn't see the irony of him living off the government, but poor people not having the right to do that if it's needed. So you run into that a lot. So, yes, it's a big cultural colander down there. Only so much information gets through. And these are Trump supporters. This explained it, the whole journey explained to me the Trump phenomenon.
Did you ultimately wind up, I mean, one of the questions that we're all having this week is, you know, when this is all over, we've gotten very bad at talking to one another, and the kinds of cultural and political isolation that you're describing has been a big problem. But somehow or other, you know, unless this is the decline and fall of American civilization, which is actually our next topic on the show today,
sure.
You know, we're going to have to learn to, like, you managed to find some common cause with these people. You're probably pretty, you are very, I know you, you're very different from those people, but ultimately you could find some things to like and love about them. Did that give you any hope, or was the balance more tipped towards, wow, we're just living on different planets here?
Unfortunately, the balance is tipped towards a permanently divided country, and I think after the election, no matter who wins, we're going to be going through a period of quite instability. There's other factors, like the folks in Oregon who managed to get over the charges of armed occupation of the wildlife refuge out there, and that sort of thing. But here's the big example I would give. You know, and I remember this. I grew up in a Protestant community, but in a Catholic family. And I remember the hostility to John Kennedy running for president in 1960 because a Catholic would take his directions from the Pope. And what did John Kennedy do? He went down to a meeting of ministers, of evangelical Protestant ministers in West Virginia, and just absolutely disabused them of their fears about him and was totally charming. And they all stood up and clap for him at the end. It was a pivotal moment in the 1960 campaign. I don't think we have leadership like that anymore. And as much as I think Obama did a great job in many respects, I don't think he confronted the belly of the beast that way. We need politicians who will go to that area of the country and say, look, this is the amount of federal money that comes into your state. You're a net gainer. You collect as much welfare as anybody else, and explain why. I have a whole long section in my Oregon Trail book about how the West, which is big Trump country, collects way more in federal subsidies than they pay in taxes. And the problem is, I don't think we don't have John Kennedy going to West Virginia anymore. The whole strategy of this campaign, look at this, is Hillary's got to go to the states where it's a swing state and she's within 4%, so she's got a campaign there to try and get it. But she's already winning there. She's almost winning. She's not going to Alabama or Tennessee or some Mississippi, these conservative states, and saying she's not confronting the opposition.
That's a great point, and I haven't heard anybody quite make that point, that people tend to campaign where they're strongest and not talk to the people that they most need to talk to. Rinker Buck, we're going to have to go, but thank you so much for your time. This is writer and author Rinker Buck, who's sailed down the Monongahela, Ohio, and Mississippi rivers on an old-fashioned early 19th century style flatboat. Talk to the people he saw along the way. We're going to talk to a correspondent from the New York Times when we get back about how things look when America is looked at from abroad.
What do you think about Americans?
I think the average Swiss thinks that the average American is not so intelligent. Like,
I don't think anyone thought that Trump would get as far as he is, and the fact that it got so far reflects on the American population.
What I see in social media, it shows me Americans aren't really that smart.
They're joyful people, but sometimes they're a bit obnoxious.
Those are voices from the mean streets of Switzerland. Those were collected by Kyle Schock from Little Globe News, a Swiss news agency put together by our own Josh Nalea. We're going to talk about how America looks from abroad with Nick Corasaniti, a digital correspondent for The New York Times. He covers messaging in politics, tech, media. He's been covering Donald Trump's campaign. He co-wrote a piece this weekend that it would be hilarious and is kind of hilarious if it weren't also so sad and alarming. And it is kind of as though, you know, sometimes a friend will say, does this dress make me look fat? Well, Nick and other writers and journalists kind of said to people in other places or observed people in other places answering the question, does this election make me look like we're actually having the decline and fall of civilization here in America? And the answer is kind of maybe yes. So Nick Corasaniti, welcome to the conversation.
Hey, thanks for having me, Colin.
So this piece, it ranges all over the place and it ranges across lots of different continents. But there is sort of a common theme, you know, and I guess what? The theme is kind of, well, we don't necessarily look to you anymore as a shining city on the hill. In some ways, you've got the kinds of problems we're used to having to solve. Like, I think it was even, there was one from Africa where there was some group that was almost facetiously suggesting, do you want us to help you put a union together?
Yeah, that actually came. That was a believe it or not, a social media hashtag called hashtag November 8th Africa election. It was mostly in Nigeria, but it spanned to a few other countries where they were kind of poking fun at the problems we were having. That came about, I think, like 2 or 3 weeks ago when the Comey letter first came out, you know, kind of poking fun at the thralls that the election keeps seeming to fall into.
You begin the piece in India, right-wing Hindus who pray at their temple for Donald Trump to defeat Islamic terrorism. In Saudi Arabia, a crown prince who engaged in a Twitter war with Mr. Trump. Dopey prince, Mr. Trump called him. In Mexico, economists who predict that the peso will plummet if Mr. Trump wins. In Japan, a generation that has taken United States military protection for granted but worries it might no longer be able to do so. You know, Nick, if you were to ask most Americans to discuss politics in India or even Saudi Arabia or Japan, most of them would not be able to tell you anything, really. But it just does seem as though other countries are watching our election.
Oh, I think absolutely. I mean, I think the U.S. elections are always kind of at the forefront of a lot of, you know, foreign news outlets. I can just see when I'm traveling with the Trump campaign, you know, there's a lot of international press there, everywhere from Japan to, you know, Mexican newspapers. But I also think that this one has been just so uniquely dominating. It takes over all cable news, which also, you know, goes abroad. And there's just been such a fascination with it. I mean, in the different people that we spoke to for this article, there was a certain amount of just sheer surprise and kind of disbelief that this is where this election that started with, you know, 17 on one side and had seemingly started for Hillary Clinton so many years ago on the other, had kind of reached this point. And I think that's also kind of what came across in the pieces we were doing, was it was just a kind of sense of like shock and surprise that they weren't used to seeing this out of American elections, which is what's drawn so much attention towards it.
One thing you kind of allude to, I think, you know, many people who travel have had the experience of going to a really interesting place in a different country, in a different part of the world, and going shopping for maybe something to take home that really reminds you, some piece of clothing or something that reminds you of where you are. And sometimes you really have to hunt around for a place that isn't selling you stuff that looks American and claims to be American. There's that kind of sense in an awful lot of countries that the coolest thing would probably be an American thing. And it's also been very true of the culture that we have exported for years, especially music and stuff like that. But I get the feeling reading your piece, even the luster of that has faded a little bit.
Well, that's actually one of the things that we tried to get at in the piece, and it was a hard thing to find, you know, a lot of data, especially at this point, you know, certain sales and everything aren't up to quarter, and, you know, polling data hasn't been done since April. So we were talking to Hollywood executives and whatnot, and they couldn't offer any real data, but they were saying that they felt a similar way, and that both people reaching back towards nostalgia so they could think about times when they were happier to be an American, and then also certain movies, like one of my favorite, this didn't make it into the story, but one of my favorite interviews was with a Hollywood producer who couldn't figure out why Independence Day 2 flopped, whether it was just because it was objectively a bad movie, or if the whole thought of rallying around, the world rallying around in America to fight a foreign alien wasn't good enough. It wasn't America who would be leading that. So it was like a very interesting thought. And then even just looking at, you know, the sales of not necessarily American flags abroad, but American brands. Like, I remember when I lived in New Zealand, everyone still wore Yankee hats. Mm. So we were seeing how much Yankee hats were out there. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily seem like there's some huge drop-off or anything, but there is an awareness of, like, what represents America is now not necessarily worn around as much from what people were telling us.
So since you're mentioning Australia and New Zealand, we do want to talk about a resolution that passed in the New South Wales Parliament. We actually have a little clip of the member of Parliament who introduced that resolution doing exactly that.
Mr. President, I give notice that on the next sitting day, I will move one, that this House, A, condemns the misogynistic, hateful comments made by the Republican candidate for the President of the United States of America, Mr. Donald Trump, about women and minorities, including the remarks revealed over the weekend that clearly describe sexual assault. B, reflects on the divisive, destructive impacts that hate speech from political candidates and members of elected office has on our community. C, agrees with those who have described Mr. Donald Trump as a revolting slug unfit for office.
President. All right, I believe that man's name is Jeremy Carmichael, proposing that resolution. And Nick, one of the exciting things about that is it passed unanimously and apparently without even really anybody kind of pushing back against it.
No, not a single MP stood up against it. And, you know, that was, you know, what our piece tried to get at was more America and less any critique on either candidate. But what Lyle Mercer told Farah, who interviewed her for the article, was that, you know, it was notable in the fact that people were willing to do this and no one stood up. And this is, you know, it's a close election and this is the potential next president. And the United States is one of Australia's closest allies, yet here they are passing a resolution just literally insulting him and calling out, you know, what they see as like divisive rhetoric in his campaign. So that alone, the willingness to do that kind of shows like a diminished respect or awe that, you know, some of our allies might have for us. I was also speaking to Riva Levinson, who is a she heads up a consulting firm in Washington, and she pointed to the withdrawal of South Africa, Gambia, and Burundi from the International Criminal Court. And she said that, you know, that happened at a time when the election was particularly tumultuous. And while they didn't necessarily cite the U.S. Elections, she said, you know, you have to wonder whether the U.S. political climate offered like a nice distraction or a convenient moment for these governments who are all under fire for different reasons to take a decision that would be universally condemned. Like, is the diminishment of the U.S. moral authority through this election, you know, allowing behavior like that?
We're talking to Nick Corasaniti, a digital correspondent for The New York Times. So one of the places where American relations are always fraught, or at least have been fraught for a really long time, is the Middle East. There are places where there's some sympathy and places where there's not. And there's a lot of places where we're seen as meddling. You talked to a correspondent for a newspaper in Lebanon who said that really things have really changed and that even the pockets of sympathy seem to be evaporating.
Yeah, and I think that also comes from that sense of just surprise and awe that I was speaking about earlier, that, you know, people have watched this and the kind of slow roll of this election as it was covered every day to where we are right now. Like, that sheer surprise is what's kind of eroded, I think, even places where there was like already minimal sympathy. You know, we're kind of at a place where certain, you know, we've come into countries, say, in the Middle East and said, you know, you need to understand the American way and the American democracy is the way. And they're looking back at us and saying, we don't necessarily want that right now if this is what it is.
Well, Nick, we hate to give people nothing but negative news. We hate to end on a negative note. So I think we need to talk about Canada. Canada has really kind of taken a different approach. It's a slightly there's a fine line between empathy and patronizing. I'm not sure exactly where on that line Canada is, although I think we should give the Canadians the benefit of the doubt. They seem to feel genuinely sorry for us.
They do. So this is another one that kind of took off on social media first. It was a hashtag, Tell America It's Great. And I'm sure there was a little bit of patronizing in there, or some tongue-in-cheek humor, saying that the French fry is an American invention or things like that. But what was kind of notable was, I don't know the exact name of the ad agency, but some ad agency then created like a UCG or user-generated content ad, and they put it on YouTube of a bunch of Canadians speaking into their webcams and saying why America was great. And some of them were really heartfelt, and they did point to the fact that, you know, despite this divisive election, there's still so much good in the country and in the world that America represents, that there's plenty to be proud of, and there's also plenty to recognize and embrace and rally around when this whole election's over. And so if there's one thing to take away for the good news of this, I would say it's not even to look at that hashtag, but it's to go watch that video. And you'll see, you know, maybe not everything is so bad.
All right. Well, so let's end on that bright note. But people should read more of this story. There's tons more material there about the way this election is regarded in Europe and by Russia and all kinds of stuff. Nick Korasuniti, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, we're going to take a little break right now. When we come back, I'm going to just open up the phone lines as we do periodically. I don't think we actually, there's no thing that happens when we open up the phone lines. It's more of a trope. But 860-275-7266. You can call in and unburden yourself in any particular way. But let me put out one thing there, which is we at WNPR have to make some choices about how we cover tomorrow and how we cover the day after. So if there's something in particular that you would like to see us do, or an avenue you'd like to see us go down, or something you feel like we ought to explore that's underexplored, that would be an especially good thing to call up about. But I'm not restricting the calls in any particular way. And the number again, 860-275-7266. Give us a call during this break and we'll get you right on after that.
Earthquake. Our neighbors have faced it alone, and I'm one Canadian who is damn tired of hearing them kicked around. They'll come out of this thing with their flag high, and when they do, they're entitled to thumb their noses at the lands that are gloating over their present troubles. I hope Canada is not one of these, but there are many smug, self-righteous.
The Australian resolution denouncing Donald Trump as a revolting slug has come under fire from the International Brotherhood of Slugs. They're so thin-skinned, those slugs. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kyone Wolf. Katie Tilarski is the executive producer of our show and appeared in the intro. The part of Bill Curry was played by Rhines. Tomorrow, get ready for our traditional Citizens Observer show. And now, back to Colin.
May not be all that necessary to learn how to say Rhines Priebus, because I don't think he's going to be the Republican National Chairman anymore, unless Trump wins tomorrow. If Trump wins tomorrow, then no, he still won't be. Rhines doesn't have a win here, does he? He doesn't. I mean, Trump is going to purge him, and he's going to get purged if Clinton wins. So he'll be a lawyer in Kenosha, Wisconsin. I believe that's where he's from. You can check me on that. Oh, and I have to make a correction from the previous segment. But I have to remember the mistake I made. I said that the Minister of Parliament from the New South Wales Parliament was named Justin Carlyle. No, or Jeremy Carlyle. I'm actually making a mistake in the correction. His real name is Jeremy Buckingham. Jeremy Buckingham. That's the person who you heard call Trump a revolting slug. We'll get a lot of mail, like a huge amount of mail from New South Wales if I don't fix things like that. So a huge, tremendous amount of mail. All right. So there is no plan in this particular segment other than to talk to you. The number is 860-275-7266. You can talk about what you would like us to cover tomorrow, what you think we haven't covered very well, or just, you know, unburden yourself of whatever your concerns are. Maybe you're a little bit worried about being able to vote tomorrow. The Justice Department, actually, it's kind of a surprising thing. The Justice Department is sending observers to like a lot of Connecticut towns. I mean, we seem to be heavily targeted suddenly by the Justice Department. They're going to be in East Hartford, West Hartford, and I think New Britain and other places as well. And even if you look at the kind of overall list of where people are being sent, I'm not sure why we deserve such attention. But anything you want to talk about, 860-275-7266. Do a couple more housekeeping things. You just heard Jeff Cohen talking about our big Facebook Live project. At some point tomorrow, John Dankosky and I will do a mini Facebook Live wheelhouse. Usually the wheelhouse is John and me plus two other panelists, which is what it'll be this Wednesday when we're on with Suzanne Bates and Kalila Brown-Dean. But it'll be just me and John, and we might like put like scarecrows or dummies or something in the other chairs just so we don't. Do we still have the big cutout of Yo-Yo Ma? Do we have that? So maybe Yo-Yo Ma will be on with us. And also want to mention one more time, Kion Wolf is activating a voicemail project on how people plan to cope emotionally on Election Day. Will you be spending time with your friends? Will you be screaming into the void all alone, rocking back and forth? That would be me. Self-medicating with a nice long hike away from screens? Not a bad idea. Leave a message at 860-580-9677. We got four voicemails already as a result of my announcing that once. So that's going to be great. So here we go now. We're going to start with Richard from Waterbury, our number 860-275-7266. Hi, Richard. You're right on the air right now.
Hi, Colin. How are you doing?
Good.
Yeah, I wanted to comment. I think it was Ringer Buck. Is that the name of the guy who did the flatboat?
Yeah, Rinker Buck. Very common name.
Wonderful, very, very evocative story there. And I thought he made a good point about the fact that these folks down there that he was talking to are so utterly fact-free in forming their opinions. Mm-hmm. And then he sort of said, well, you know, the media kind of fails on one regard. And he said, well, you know, if you listen to Fox News, you get one version. If you listen to MSNBC, you get another version. And neither one of them are reality. And I have to dispute that. I mean, I am a self-confessed progressive, but I tell you something. MSNBC does not represent opinion as fact. And generally speaking, when they say something, it is not a complete lie. Hmm. So if the general public are receiving completely tainted information from a large portion of the media, and I know how powerful Fox is, and I also know how powerful right-wing radio is. If people are getting that just driven into them day after day, and there isn't a counterbalancing source of truth and fact coming at them from other powerful media sources, it's no wonder that you have a country that is now politically divided, but also I fear racially divided. And after this election, if Trump loses or wins, whatever way, you're going to either empower a really, really racialized, extreme kind of white power movement, or you're going to have a whole portion of the country, a large section of the country, that is fired up and ready to do battle with non-whites. And that's very, very disturbing to me.
All right. Yeah, thanks for your call. I'll just say that one thing that I mean, first of all, it certainly is the case that there are things that are being represented as facts, which are not. I did a column this weekend. We're not allowed at the Hartford Courant to write about politics within 2 or 3 days of the election. So my column was running Sunday. I couldn't do it about the election or politics or anything. So I wrote about pumpkin spice. But I set the whole thing up with a series of every statement was preceded by the words true fact. True fact. And a number of people wrote to criticize me and tell me that was redundant. And I kept writing back saying, have you been paying attention during this election cycle? There are many things that are represented to you as facts, which are not true. And you know, I mean, I think it's fair to say that a lot of us do see that happening more on right-wing media. Ira Glass had this tremendous clip that he played about 3 weeks ago of Rush Limbaugh saying, you know, people don't believe me when I say this. People say, oh, that can't be right. And when I tell them that there was no immigration to the United States, none at all, from 1928 to 1949, it was some like really long period of time. And he kept going, and people don't believe it when I say that. And then Ira said, well, they don't believe it because it's not true. And then he explained how much immigration there's been. So, yeah, there is that. I think there's at a more subtle level and maybe a less accusatory level towards the right-wing media. There's also people wind up just paying attention to different storylines. And it isn't necessarily that the other storyline isn't true, but we just, you know, depending on what kind of media you're following, you're just going to be aware of different storylines, different aspects to things. And some of that is, it's not entirely a matter of, as I say, one side telling lies, just as it is, you know, there's a whole bunch of facts. There's a 100% universe of facts. We can only probably pay attention to about 30% of them. And so then it's which 30% are we paying attention to? All right. So let's go down the line here. Here's Peter in Preston. Hi, Peter.
Hey, how are you?
All right.
Well, that's wonderful. I'm not sure how I am today. You know, worried a little bit about tomorrow.
I was lying anyway. So.
Yeah.
That was not a true fact.
Yeah. Hey, we have a little place in a lovely little hamlet called Sandy Cove, which is in Nova Scotia, which, as you know, is Canada. And one of the things this summer for the – we were up to 3 months – that I heard over and over again is they cannot believe what is going on here. Mm-hmm. Basically, they think we're all a little bit cracked. And I wanted to just sort of pass that comment on because I love the recording of, I guess it was it England in Parliament.
Yeah, there was Australia.
Mr. Trump.
Yeah.
I thought that was spot on. The other thing that I'm very concerned about is this whole experience level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Hillary certainly has a great deal of experience in government. Mr. Trump doesn't, and I keep thinking if I was going to have a major operation, I don't think I'd go to a veterinarian.
Right.
And that really worries me a great deal. You know, Trump's a hate monger. He's just for whatever.
Oop.
I can't quite figure it out. He has convinced everybody they should hate Hillary. And I asked a very close friend of mine who's a Trump fan the other night, why are you voting for Trump? And he couldn't give me an answer. You know, I said,
I think there's a lot of that going around, Peter. Yeah, I just want to make sure we get to a few more people here. Let's do Cindy real quick, and then maybe try to get to Mike from West Hartford, too. Hi, Cindy. You're on the air.
Okay. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
It isn't really a question. It's an observation. We have over 350 million people in this country,
mm-hmm.
and we ended up with two people that nobody likes. And I think part of it is our primary system, and especially caucuses. It means that a very small group of people gets to decide who our candidates are.
Yeah, although one thing I will tell you, I may stand to be corrected here, but I don't think so. I think statistically, Bernie Sanders did a lot better in caucus states than he did in primary states. That, you know, his supporters tended to do better in a situation where they didn't need big numbers. They just needed an awful lot of focus. I absolutely agree with you that we are perceived as having made a very bad set of choices, and I think we feel as though we're being offered a set of choices other than the ones we might want. How to fix the primary system, that's going to be an interesting thing for us to consider. I think each party has the opposite idea from the other. Here's Mike in West Hartford. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Listen, I was harkening back to your show you did with Trump supporters.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, in the aftermath of all of this, I feel like there's a lot of people out there just harkening back to the last caller who feels like, you know, the choices aren't great. And how that drives apathy, especially in that, you know, barely more than 50% of the populace who's eligible to vote actually votes in presidential elections. So I'm wondering if there's a possibility you might do a show with those folks, because I don't think it's a question that they don't care. I think it's a question that they just feel as though their issues are not being, you know, expressed or heard. And I have to say I'm a Green supporter, so I don't know if I count amongst those folks, but at least, you know, to give an airing, because I think there's a lot of issues in this campaign that were not aired at all, such as, you know, climate change, crime, capital punishment, all that sorts of things. You never heard about those things in this campaign at all. And I feel like we're progressively missing out on the issues.
I think that's a completely valid complaint. And I think in particular climate change, which, you know, could really affect the destiny of all of us, will affect. It's not a could. It will affect the destiny of all of us has been just notably under-talked during this campaign. All right. So I probably won't get a chance to talk to you before you vote. So go off and vote. You can imagine how I want you to vote, but that doesn't make any difference. You just voted for whoever you think is going to do the best job. We will be back with you tomorrow afternoon with our Citizens Observer program, and check out Facebook Live all day tomorrow at the WNPR page. Thanks to everybody who helped out today.
How Americans see America.
You, the
people have the power to make this life free and beautiful, to make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us use that power. Let us all unite.
How the rest of the world sees America.
I don't know what I said. I don't remember.
Yeah, I'm still trying to find my sense of humor about this one.